webcasting to the world live the good news of God's love for all humanity. This is the Gospel Revolution Radio Network. Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein online. It's Wednesday. It's hump day. It's May 14th, 2008. The only May 14th, 2008 in the history of the world. Let us make it the best possible. Help you over the hump of the week. I cannot think of a better way to help you over this week than with good news of the gospel. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, much to the chagrin of religion and legalists, you're all okay with God. You're righteous, you're perfect, you're beautiful, you're holy. You're all together, already right in the sight of God. This is the Gospel Revolution webcast. This is Glenn Klein Online. Welcome you in onto this Wednesday night webcast. We've got Michael Williams from the home office of the Gospel Revolution in Houston, Texas. And nothing could be better. Michael!
Glenn!
How are you?
I am marvelously wonderful today.
You are marvelously made.
I am.
God saw you in the womb.
Marvelously and gloriously made.
Yes, we can affirm that, and we're happy to do that. How are you tonight?
Well, I am a most holy reverend.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that word reverend, because Andy Rooney was on the IMUS program, which is now on RFD-TV and a number of stations around the country since he's come back. And Andy Rooney pointed out that calling somebody Reverend Wright, for example, is grammatically incorrect, because reverend is describing somebody. It's an adjective. It's not a title.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very taken aback by that, because it's so accepted to call people of the cloth the reverend.
Yeah. Well, you know, I declined. Actually, of course, I use that term jokingly with all my friends when I call, you know, make sure I introduce myself as the most holy reverend Michael Williams. But my goodness, it's probably been 25 years ago. I was wondering where the term came from. So being biblically based as I am, I did a search. I got my Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, and I found the term reverend in the Bible. And the only reference it made was holy and reverend is the Lord. And I thought, I don't think I qualify. So,
well, ironically, you do now qualify.
Yeah, that's right. But the term reverend, I also qualify, but I'm not the Lord either.
Yes, but you are as holy and reverent as the Lord.
Yes.
And that's a beautiful thing. It's a funny thing, because obviously those in the clergy or the ministry, the Reverend Martin Luther King, the Reverend John Jackson, the Reverend Al Sharpton, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, they have taken that Klingon to themselves based on the fact that they have a church, based on they have a degree or some sort of distinction from a denomination. But being holy and being reverent is a distinction that God gives all humanity.
Well, in fact, the same with the term which the Catholics seem to try to hold a market on, that's the term saint, which you can't become a saint until you ain't here no more. So,
not only can you not be a saint until you're dead, but you can't be a saint until they've done some exhaustive research, which
yes,
they're doing on John Paul II right now to prove that miracles have come through your life.
Yes.
And that would be a hard thing to prove for any human being. But isn't it interesting, Michael, that according to the gospel that we preach, that all the miracles that Jesus did gets credited to us?
Yes, it is. That is very true. And I think that that is the marvelous thing about the gospel. Well, there's everything that is the gospel is marvelous, but You know, I was thinking today as I was driving to the gym, the thought occurred to me about the terms of our spirituality, and I just, an incredible gratitude came from me that, as the reality just sank even more into my consciousness of, that there is nothing external, there is nothing about this life, there's nothing that happens in this life, there's nothing, there is not anything that does not happen in this life that defines or gives dimension or description to my spirituality or anyone else's. And the only thing that defines my spirituality is the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, which of course applies to all of humanity. And it always, always saddens me, even though people find a lot of encouragement out of it that is very temporary, when they begin to define their spirituality by external means than by experiential means, and to reduce the spiritual content and context that we've been given as human beings through the work of the cross, and to reduce it to an experience, no matter how glorious, no matter how impacting, to reduce that to a life experience or something that you see or somebody involved in your life or something that has happened. Most of the day today, I have been very consciously aware that my spirituality is defined by the work of the cross and not by anything, not by any external force in my life at all. Zero.
And I also love the quotation that is on our homepage at gospelrevolution.com, where your definition of spirituality comes to the fore, which was given right after September 11th, 2001, where you say that spirituality should be gauged not by who is excluded, but by who is included.
Yes. Yes, and I think a dear friend of mine got a title out of a book out of that, actually.
Who would that be, Michael?
I don't know. I'm not free to say in public, but... no, it is true. The only thing that gives dimension to the gospel is that there are no boundaries, you know, to extent of the righteousness of God that has abounded to the entire planet. Which, you know, Glenn, the prophets foretold that there would be a time when God's righteousness would cover the earth as the waters cover the seas, and that his knowledge would cover the earth, and that there would be no place that his righteousness would be excluded, that it would flow to the most extreme parts of this planet. And it has done that. It has indeed gone to that degree, and we have received that righteousness, and it has flooded us. You know, when I first started teaching more about the grace and the love of God, I was accused of teaching greasy grace and sloppy agape, and that was two terms that was attributed to my teaching. And I remembered doing
Well, wait a second. Why don't you define the sloppy agape and greasy grace for anybody that does not understand what you're meaning?
Well, of course, they mean it as insulting terms, you know, just that it's sloppy, you know, and that it's, you know, that it has no form, and that there's no rhyme or reason to the love of God. And they think there's a rhyme or reason. They think there's, you know, that there's limits to God's love. And greasy grace is defined as that God's approval is on someone's life regardless of what they do. So as
right.
far as
In other words, greasy grace or sloppy agape is not based on the work of the cross. We'll accept the work of the cross to the degree that we can measure up to it.
Yes. Yeah, and the interesting thing was that when I looked for the terms that I started studying, that made me study more about, you know, the love of God and the grace of God. And the interesting thing was that it actually says that God has lavished his love upon us, which actually means sloppy. So so they were correct. But I was teaching correct doctrine. I was teaching the lavished love of God or the sloppy agape, which either term is quite all right with me.
It's Glenn Klein Online. We're talking, as is our desire every Wednesday night, to Michael Williams of the Gospel Revolution, and inviting you to participate in the webcast tonight. If you're listening live, and it's between 9 and 10 o'clock Eastern Time, we want to hear from you. Just call us on the Glenn Klein Online toll-free hotline at 1-800-436-3260. That number is 1-800-436-3260. Sean O'Halloran, our call screener, producer, and engineer extraordinaire, is waiting to hear from you. We want to hear from you. The webcast is so enhanced when you pick up the phone and dial. We're always waiting for that first call because it always seems like it takes one caller to call in and to participate and have their questions or their voice or their comments be heard. And so we want to hear from you. 1-800-436-3260. 1-800-436-3260. I am broadcasting from the northern outpost of the Gospel Revolution in northern Wisconsin. Michael's in Houston. Sean is waiting for your call in Tampa, Florida, and we're waiting to hear from you wherever you are listening from. You can also, if you want, especially if you're listening on the archive, you can email us your questions at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. That address, once again, is webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Well, Mikey, we sent out an email today encouraging everybody to up and register for the Gospel Revolution Convention in November in Houston. And frankly, ladies and gentlemen, it would not be an exaggeration, Michael, to say hundreds of people ask us over the years, where do I go? Where can I meet with people who think like this? Where can I meet with people that believe that God's faith in us supersedes our faith in him? Mm-hmm. And so at long last, we've provided a venue where the Gospel Revolution, Mike Williams Ministries, is welcoming all to Houston in November, on November 5th through the 9th. And this is a time for people to go to the gospelrevolution.com website and start registering. I mean, it's up, it's ready, we're ready to rock and roll. We're at the Marriott Houston North at Greenpoint, and we're ready to go. We're really strongly trying to motivate people to get online and to make their reservations for the conference in November.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, Glenn, in the big scheme of things, we actually do have a limited space. If we get the full response that we have been asked according to what we've been asked to do, we would not be able to handle the numbers that would be there. We have a certain number of rooms that have been set aside, and we are already down, I think, into the 30s. On those rooms, people need to be not only going on to the website and signing up for the conference, which they are. We have people are already doing that, obviously, but also make early reservations for the Marriott because we can guarantee that room rate. For the total rooms that we have set aside, which is now down into the 30s that we have left of those rooms for $109 a night. Quite a savings on that. They're, 30-40% or something that's off on those rooms. And so to absolutely guarantee that price, you have to get into one of those 50 rooms. So they will offer those if they have them available. And I honestly don't know what they quantify being available is. So just to make sure that you get the lower rooms, right, try to get one of these rooms that are left now.
Right. Well, one of the things that has distinguished this effort, obviously the message has distinguished this effort from anything else that talks about the Bible or about Jesus or about God. But we've tried to be completely straight up with you folks, and we've done it during our pledge efforts. We're doing the convention because you've asked for it.
Yeah.
But, Michael, we've had to take kind of a step of faith, if you will, thinking that we're going to have a certain number of people show up to this thing.
Yes.
And initially, with the Marriott, we guaranteed 50 rooms. And now we're into the 30s, as Michael said, but we have had to personally guarantee that. And when I say personally, there's no money in the ministry to guarantee it. We've taken this step.
Yeah.
And I know that there are literally hundreds and hundreds of people listening to this right now, whether it be live or on the webcast, or like, you know, I want to be there, I need to be there. Folks, if you have any inkling at all that you want to come, to make a reservation with the Marriott, and all you got to do is go to the gospelrevolution.com webpage and just follow the instructions. You click on there. There's a toll-free number. You have an email access.
Oh, you can see the rooms and everything.
And you can see the rooms. Obviously, to make a reservation for a hotel room 6 months in advance, it doesn't cost you anything. What it is saying to us is that there's this level of interest, and then as we go down the road, we'll know how many more rooms we need or if we're going to meet our goal, which is 50 rooms. And this is hopefully the first annual event like this. But for you folks that really love this message and want to experience the gathering of humanity that understands that everybody, not just the ones that are going to be gathering, but everybody who will not be gathering, is righteous in God, this is your opportunity to step up and to be counted. Just go to the gospelrevolution.com webpage, go through the registration process with the hotel. There's a form in there that it asks you to fill out for the conference. We're going to have, obviously, Michael being the featured teacher. Carlton Pearson's going to be there, and you know that Carlton has had a dramatic evolution of his thought. And Michael, you were not just a little part of that evolution from Carlton Pearson being on TBN, being on Oral Roberts' board at ORU, to where he's at right now, which what he calls the gospel of inclusion.
Yes, and I'm looking very much forward when Carlton addresses crowds from the Christian community. He has a tremendous persuasion and very, very strong ability to encourage people in the gospel. And so we're looking very much forward. He's been a friend for several years now, and we're looking forward to sharing this time together with him and with our other speakers. So we've got a table spread, so come on in.
That's exactly right. And we're inviting you to come in tonight here at the Glenn Klein Online webcast by calling us. We know there's folks that are listening live as we speak at about 9:20 Eastern Time in the United States. We want to hear from you. The webcast is so much enhanced when you participate by calling 1-800-436-3260, 1-800-436-3260. Sean, I'm not getting any emails right now, so if you or when you get a call, or feel free to break in on the microphone and let us know that there's somebody waiting to talk to us. 1-800-436-3260 is the toll-free number, or as always, You can webcast us, or you can email us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. The number is webcast@gospelrevolution.com. That's the email address. If you're listening on the archive especially, we've got a bunch of questions lined up, but we would love to hear from you at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Michael, it is amazing to me, as both you and I do follow the news quite closely, how amazingly parallel the news of the so-called world, whether it be on CNN or MSNBC or ABC or Fox, it doesn't make a difference. It's following the line of the Christian apocalyptic message about this cyclone, this hurricane, this earthquake. It's all coming to a head.
Yeah.
And what I think both the secular media and the Christian church has forgot is history. The things that we're seeing now that are reported instantly by these networks have been going on for thousands of years, and yet people look to those things as a sign of the end of the times.
Yeah, and the bizarre thing is that Jesus, in his addressing the term the end of the age or the end of the world, went through that very same list that and more. Starvation, which is now becoming a real problem on the planet because of some possibly very foolish presumptions. But all of this list was in Matthew 24. And Jesus named every one of them and said, these things have always happened and they'll be continue to happen, but this is not a sign of the end. And if you read it in context, he is saying these are not signs of the end, of the end of the age, whatever that would be, even if it was the end of the planet. But it's much easier to apply that and try to say that he's saying that these things are going to happen when the planet is ready to terminate, because these are very disturbing things that are happening on the planet. And all Jesus was saying, 2,000 years ago, Jesus was saying that it's happened before, it'll happen again, but the end is not yet. This is not one of the ways to determine the end. And in fact, then had the audacity to be very specific about his prophecies, not like many of our modern-day prophets who prophesy there's going to be earthquakes this year, or our beloved Pat Robertson, who prophesied his last two New Year's prophecies have been dead out wrong, and his last one for last year, which closed out in December, was that 2007... that the coasts of the United States would be ravaged by storms in an unprecedented way. And it was unprecedentedly quiet around the shores of the U.S. for that entire year. But Jesus didn't make wrong predictions, number one, and he certainly didn't make vague ones. He said if you want to know when the end is going to come, he said this gospel of the kingdom, which he was preaching, would be preached throughout the entire world, which the term world, everybody's got a concordance, look it up. It means a region, specifically the Roman Empire, which the message that Jesus preached had gone out to the entire Roman Empire. Jesus was crucified in the Roman Empire when the end of the world took place. And the end did come. And it was the end of everything that the disciples pointed to that day. And a lot of my really close friends look at that and delay the fulfillment of that prophecy unto the year 70 AD. But
those people are called preterists.
Yes, preterists, and the wonderful. Let me tell you, the wonderful people. These are a lot of very close friends of mine now. And as I've said to them, you know, we were only 37 years apart, you know, on the completed work of the cross, but I still maintain that this work was completed at the cross, because you've got to understand, we're talking about God's view of things, not man's view of things. And in God's view, the entire world system, the age, came to an end at the cross. Because the cross was designed to affect the entire planet, not just the Jewish community. When the walls of the temple came down, that affected the Jews in 70 AD. That did not affect the entire planet. The cross was the end of the world for the entire planet. It was the end of the law. Not just in Jerusalem, but on the entire face of the planet Earth. And it ended in God's eyes. And even the veil of the temple was rent in two. The stones did not come down until later. In fact, even then, not all the stones came down from one another. Because even Jesus said that not one stone would be left upon the other. But even that, they still go to the Wailing Wall. There's still a wall there. So the emphasis is that we have to go back to the scriptures and what the emphasis was. And again, the power of the cross is to understand that cities and countries and people were simply players on the stage. It was not about them. They were there to demonstrate and to reveal something much greater, that all of the scriptures were about Jesus. The scriptures were not about Jerusalem. They were not about Judea. They were not about Israel. The scriptures were not about the temple. The scriptures were about Jesus, because Jesus himself said that all the law and the Psalms and the prophets, he said, were concerning him. It was all about him. And so anyway, this tremendous end, and as you said, I mean, they're warning people and on the news, my goodness, this horrible devastation in China and Myanmar, the former Burma, and it's, my goodness, you know, when we were on last week, they were estimating 22,000, and now it's over 100,000 dead from the cyclone. And probably multiple times, they're saying possibly a million to die from the impact of this, from the starvation and disease and everything coming after that. And now in China, I mean, an area, they said this earthquake there, Glenn, jolted an area the size of the United States.
Well, they're clearly in major sin there.
You know, they have to be. It's where, you know, they're worshiping the wrong gods. Of course, there's just, you know, the Christians that happen to be there just in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, because God doesn't seem to be able to direct his judgment anymore.
And of course, the storms that came through the United States this last week, the tornadoes and the devastation and the fatalities, just happened to hit right through the buckle of the Bible Belt. I haven't heard any comments yet from Pat Robertson or from John Hagee or from Rod Parsley about why there would be such devastation in places like Oklahoma and Texas and Missouri, where there's a lot of born-again Christian people in those areas.
Yeah, and a lot of their support comes from. So, you know, you're not going to tell them, you know, God's judging them, not when it's going to cut off the money.
But what would they say, Michael? What would your hardcore, word of faith, Bible-thumping preacher say about devastation, not unlike what happened in the former Burma or in China with the earthquake, but where good old-fashioned Bible believers are? What would they say?
Well, that then would be what I would call, coined years ago, as doctrines of convenience. They would then say that these were righteous and good people, and the devil was mad at them for spreading the gospel. So then the hurricane or the tornado or the earthquake would be the devil doing it. And it's just utterly amazing how that it's up to man's judgments to determine those things. And but either way, they've got an answer for it.
It would not be a stretch to say that a lot of them would say that, well, those people there did not have the right kind or enough faith.
Oh, no, they would say that also. But if they, if it happened to them, if it happened to Regent University, or if it happened at ORU, if a tornado went right through the middle of ORU, it would be the devil. It would not be a lack of faith. Now, if it happened to the house next to ORU or next to Regent University in Virginia Beach, then it would be their lack of faith, or possibly even the devil. You know, all of these things, it's just amazing how that people shut off their minds and don't think for themselves and sit and back and let people tell them, you know, this is God and this is the devil, even though it's the very same act, just depending on, you know, whose side you're on at what place.
Well, it's our pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to uncover the veil of this silliness each and every week, and frankly, with all of our efforts. This is inconsistent. This is really without conscious that these people make these kind of claims. And we're happy to be part of the effort that is uncovering the truth. And the nice thing with our effort is that we are not denying the work of the cross. We are not denying the existence of God. We are not denying the holiness of God, as some commentators will, and they will scoff at it. In fact, we are using the same book, the Bible, to verify and validate what we're saying. As far as we know, Michael, we're the only effort that is using the same book that the fundamentalists are using, that the Catholic Church is using, that to a degree, fundamentals Islam and Orthodox Judaism is using to say, no, this is not God. You are already accepted to God.
Yeah.
We're the one that has gone into the Bible and has pulled out in context the actual meaning and definition of these issues. And the fact of the matter is that obviously we believe it, but what we're saying is that what we're teaching and what you have brought forth over these years makes a lot more sense than anything that is coming from Tulsa or Virginia Beach or from Columbus, Ohio, or anywhere else on the planet.
Well, we would just challenge everyone to do the very same, that everyone has the right and the duty to do, and that is do as Jesus said, search the scriptures, but for God's sake, find out what they are first.
All right, so you've referenced the scriptures a couple of times on this particular webcast, so for the beautiful humans, why don't you define the scriptures according to the Bible?
Well, according to Jesus, according to all of the writers of the New Testament, the scriptures are the law, the first five books of the Bible, the Psalms, the book of Psalms, and the prophets. And that is the last books of the Old Testament. And those are the only ones that are deemed to be scriptures. And in those, there is a perfect picture of the completed work of the cross. There's a perfect picture of Jesus. You're not going to figure anything out. I mean, once you limit your resource, and please understand that to limit your resource to what the author of life has told us the resource is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. But if I want to find out about salvation, according to Jesus, if I want to know about salvation, I must search the scriptures. And that's what he said. And then he also told me exactly what the scriptures are. He didn't say the book of Matthew. He didn't say the book of Revelation. He didn't say the book of James. James didn't say the book of James. Peter, James, or John, any one of them, Paul, did not say that his writings were scripture. None of them ever said, "Thus saith the Lord." All of them talked about the scriptures. All of them did their level best to teach based on what they understood the scriptures to be. But there is no less of a urgency upon any human being to understand the truth of the Word of God for us to search that out, based on the very same searches, and at least, even though that these guys disagreed with each other, and Peter, James, and John were kind of in one camp, and Paul obviously was in another camp, and we won't even try to go through there. There's so much validation for that throughout the New Testament that in their writings they disagreed with each other. They even called each other names. They would not be around each other. The amount of time that the disciples actually spent around Paul was extremely minimal. They went their separate ways and even agreed, okay, you stay on your turf and we'll stay on ours, you know. And no matter how you try to read it, these guys debated the scriptures with each other. And they wrote their view and opinion about what the scriptures said. Now, my job, your job, every listener's job, every person who wants to understand truth, all of our obligation to ourselves is to go back and look and see, does the law, the Psalms, or the prophets, and the prophets in particular, did they foretell it to be this way? Where did the prophets say that God was going to make a covenant that included man making Jesus Lord to make the covenant effective?
I like how you said that. You said it was our obligation. It's not our obligation to God, because we have no obligation to God.
No.
But it's our obligation to ourselves.
Yes.
Or to our children, or to the people that are within our sphere of influence, to have as rounded and well-versed a perspective as possible.
Absolutely. Well, especially if we call ourselves, you know, seekers of truth, then why not, if Jesus is the way, if he is the way, the truth, and the life, why not believe him about what the scriptures are? Why did I allow the Roman Catholic Church to tell me what the scriptures are? Why are Protestants still defining scripture based on what they say that all those people that are going to hell told us what the scriptures are? Why?
Isn't it ironic, Michael, that here John Hagee, who's been in the news, of course, in the wake of the controversy in the United States over Barack Obama's pastor, Jeremiah Wright's comments, and of course John Hagee has endorsed John McCain, and he's called the Catholic Church the Great Whore.
Yeah.
Which is a biblical
Chris
term.
I heard Chris Matthews trying to quote Hagee, which Chris Matthews is a Catholic. And he said that Hagee called the Catholic Church a fat whore.
Well, but the irony, of course, is that most of the doctrine that Hagee believes came from the Catholic Church.
Absolutely, he does. He's just a minor Catholic. He just, he performs the rituals of the Catholic Church. He, observes the day the Catholic Church decided to observe all of this on. And including Easter and Christmas, and we are very, very Catholic. I mean, the fact that we even have an altar is very Catholic. And going back to Jewish, actually, there's absolutely nothing New Testament about having an altar. There just isn't. The only
as the New Testament is concerned, and we're not talking about the New Testament writing, we're talking about the blood of Christ. What is the altar, Michael?
Well, the altar was in heaven. The altar was where that Jesus took his own blood and presented it to God as a sacrifice. The altars that were created through Jewish ceremony of sacrifices of all kinds, that altar was only given as a type and shadow. According to the book of Hebrews, the altar was given, since we're specifically talking about the altar was given specifically and only for a type and shadow of the real one, which was in heaven, which the earthly altar was to be done away with once the heavenly altar got used. The heavenly altar was used, making completely invalid and ineffective and of no use anything called an altar on the face of planet Earth anywhere. Because Jesus took his own blood, he as the sacrifice, took his own blood to the altar in heaven and presented his own blood, it says in Hebrews, for us, and presented us before God. Everybody says, well, we're going to stand before God. You've already stood before God. In the body of Jesus Christ, you have already stood there. Oh, my goodness, if we could just get the one-man doctrine of Paul preached throughout Galatians, Ephesians, and Philippians, and Romans, and Hebrews, the incredible one-man doctrine that Paul had a grasp of, that you only have to look at that one man. You only had to look at one man to see the sin of the world. Why is it that we can't grasp the fact that we only have to look at one man to see the righteousness of the world?
Who was the one man that we needed to look at to see the sin of the world?
Well, that, of course, that was the first Adam, as Paul compares Jesus to call Jesus the last Adam. And I remember speaking on it once, and I called him the second Adam, and somebody corrected me and said he wasn't the second one because it said he was the last one. And I said, well, yeah, that really is true, because if there was a second one, maybe there's going to be a third one. But there's not going to be a third one. There was a first one and a last one. And he was presented at the end of the world. It says that Jesus sacrificed his blood at the end of the world, which was, Jesus didn't sacrifice himself in 70 AD. Jesus sacrificed himself at the end of the world, which was at the cross. So, this is the whole, crux of the matter of being able to see that picture of just one man. Just one man. This isn't about you. Please. Man, the deadliest thing in the world we've ever done as far as misinterpreting Scripture or even what the Bible and the New Testament says about the Scriptures, we've even misinterpreted because we thought it was about us. Do one thing. Please do yourself a favor and eliminate yourself from the picture. All the players who needed to be in the Scriptures are there. You're not in there. You and I are not players in this. We are recipients. Through the types and the shadows and then the ultimate sacrifice of Jesus Christ, we are the ones who have been given this incredible and wonderful covenant that whereby we participate in a relationship with God. Now, to what degree you're aware of that relationship, what degree you enjoy it, is completely an individual and private matter. But none of those things change the covenant. The covenant had nothing to do with me. The covenant has been done for me, but it had nothing to do with me.
Do you think it would be inaccurate to describe the cross as the altar of God?
I've not stopped to think about it.
Well, because if you think about it for a second, I mean, we believe that all the writings of the Bible, all the writings of the scriptures, the Old Testament, the Law, the Psalms, and the Prophets are a foreshadowing of Christ. And we know that one thing that happened at the altar was the blood of bulls and goats was shed and spread upon the temple and the altar of God.
Yes.
And here is the ultimate shedding of blood at the cross, the blood of the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. I've looked at that passage in the scriptures and thought, this is talking about the sacrifice of the past, what Paul called, we just celebrated Passover, the Passover Lamb of God. This was the ultimate sacrifice, the pure lamb that was sacrificed. And, you know, I know that we have an understanding of Jesus going and cleansing the utensils in heaven, and thank God for it. But how we can comprehend that in our minds, I mean, we can put words to it, but I don't know if we can exactly comprehend it. But we do know that a character by the name of Yeshua, Joshua, was sacrificed in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. And Saul, this Jewish guy who was killing Christians, said that this was the Passover lamb. And so I always look at that, the altar, as what happened at Calvary, at Golgotha.
Well, and I certainly don't have any disagreement with it. The only thing is that, of course, the reference that I've been making, even in our conversation, has been that that the altar that was here was simply a type and shadow of that which was in heaven, and that Jesus presented his blood after his resurrection in the presence of God. So I don't know. I don't think that I would necessarily say that, but to say that it was not the time when the sacrifice was made, and that it was a type and shadow of that altar, absolutely.
This is Glenn Klein Online. We've got a little over 10 minutes left. We'd love to hear from you tonight. We haven't gotten a call in yet, as far as I know, although I am webcasting from the northernmost part of Wisconsin, Michaels in Houston, Texas. But Sean O'Halloran is waiting for your calls in the Glenn Klein Online studios at 1-800-436-3260, 1-800-436-3260. You want to take a couple emails?
Let's do it.
Okay. This one comes in from beautiful Vancouver Island. This is from Ken Kemp. He says, "Hey, Mike, we really enjoyed meeting you on Vancouver Island."
Yes.
"What a fun time." He says, "My boys think you're really cool, but you would look even tougher if you would wear shades." I think you wear shades from time to time, don't you?
I do, when I want to look tough.
When you want to look tough.
Yeah.
Nikki thought you were really nice. "Hope to make it to Texas, but not sure if we can yet." That, of course, referencing the Gospel Revolution Convention. Ken says, "Michael, he ordered $200 worth of CDs when you were on Vancouver Island, but haven't received them yet. He left the money with Diane, but you were busy. Just wondering if the CDs were sent." He says, "Really enjoying the show, but remind Glenn that today is hump day."
You forgot.
Well, you know, I'm in northern Wisconsin. The air is a little thinner up here in the north.
It's the only time you don't say it and you get it pointed out. How about that?
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah.
You think Ken's CDs are on their way?
They are on their way. I think what they were doing was waiting. In fact, I know what we were doing. We were waiting for the reproduction of the new series also, which most people were wanting, the new one that was in the recorder at the time. So, yes, those have been sent, and they should be there within the the time that it takes things to get from here to Vancouver Island. Normally about a week, sometimes about a week and a half, actually.
And, Ken, your point is well taken. And, folks, any time that you are missing a teaching or a thank you gift for a pledge donation, please let us know. I don't care if you've told us two or three or four times and we've sent it up the chain. We are committed to getting you what you ordered or what you have coming. So don't hesitate to let us know. All you got to do is email us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com.
Please don't take it as a lack of interest or commitment on our part, because it definitely is not that. We just simply do not have the type of organization in place that is able to make sure, which even the best organizations have things fall through the cracks, but we just don't have the organization together to sometimes make sure that everything goes as smoothly as it happens.
Well, we have the organization. We just don't have the money to pay people to plug into the organization yet. But we're desirous of that reality. So
yeah.
As you're reminded on your emails every week, just let us know what we owe you, and we are committed to getting it to you. And no matter when you get it, see, I believe in the sovereignty of God. So when you get it, it will be in perfect timing. This email comes from Grace. What a perfect name, Grace. That's my youngest daughter's name, Grace.
Yeah.
I love that name. She's from Kansas, not Florida. And she says, Mike, I was raised in the Nazarene church where they taught the need for sanctification. How does sanctification fit into grace? Do we sanctify ourselves or what? And that's from Grace in Kansas.
Good question. Of course, sanctification is anything can be sanctified, which the term sanctify simply means to be set apart for God's purpose. So there is, in fact, Paul said that he has given unto us righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. So in Paul's terminology, sanctification fits in the very same category as righteousness and redemption. So sanctification is not a process in one sense of the word. However, in the process of, I view sanctification as the very same way as I do salvation. There is a salvation that was absolutely took place. It's called redemption. There is a sanctification that took place that's called redemption also and righteousness. But that sanctification of the sanctification of the mind. But you've got to understand, we're not trying to sanctify or set ourselves apart from the things the Nazarene Church told you, Grace, that you were to sanctify yourself from. You actually need to be sanctified from what the Nazarene Church taught you.
Right. Sanctification actually means something. It actually means to be set apart from.
Yes. Absolutely.
And yeah, we want to separate ourselves from, to be separated from self-righteousness or legalism or trying to somehow earn our way with God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we definitely want to be separated from that.
Absolutely. So there is a salvation that we believe is ongoing. There's a sanctification that I think is ongoing. But suddenly sanctification is an achievable thing. You see, under what the Nazarenes told you, sanctification is not achievable because their sanctification is that you would never, I know what the Nazarenes teach, and they teach that there are some Pentecostal churches and probably some Baptists also that actually teach that you get sanctified to the point where you no longer sin. And the strange thing is that their doctrine is true, but they don't understand the completed work of the cross. But what they're saying is that you actually never do anything that would have ever, if God's law were in effect, that you would never do anything to break God's law. You are so sanctified. And that's what they deem sanctification is that once you are sanctified, you never lie, you never cheat, you never steal, you never get angry, you never any of these things. And those folks are some of the angriest people I've ever seen.
Right, you're perfect, in other words.
Yes, you're absolutely perfect in your conduct in every way, measured by God, not by man, but measured by God as perfect in what you do. And so their version of sanctification is a lie because it is not achievable, and those who say they've achieved it are liars. They are liars. However, the sanctification that I teach is achievable. Now, you may have to sanctify yourself a little bit more some days than you do others, and you might be tempted to go back into the former way of thinking. I find it a very rare occasion, if anything. I just can't even think of a time now when I've been tempted to go back, or to look at a situation and view it as in some way as evaluating the performance of God in my life or my performance before God. And please understand that this gospel goes both ways. Thank God. It not only eliminates your thought that God is evaluating your performance, but you will never know freedom until you know the grace to stop evaluating God's performance. That is the greatest freedom that a human being will ever experience pertaining to spirituality.
You mean God's performance in our lives?
God's performance in our lives.
Yeah, not God's performance in the life of Jesus.
No. In fact, that's why that we don't have to evaluate God's performance in our lives, is because the performance of God in Jesus' life has forever sealed what has been done. And a lot of people take verses out of context and says, yeah, but it says that he will, that God is faithful, that to complete that which he has started, or to whatever that they say it, but it actually says that he will perform that which he's already done, which only means that he will maintain that which he has already done. It doesn't mean that he will keep doing something to make sure that it's okay. It just means that it is perpetually done. And so I tell you what, for me, I am so grateful that I no longer have to evaluate God in my life. Mm-hmm. Life is life, and my spirituality is absolutely secured through the work of the cross. And I know that God is not evaluating my performance, and oh, thank God I gave up on evaluating God's performance in my life and in my situations. I just don't do it anymore.
You know, we say that leads to an awful lot
of mental strife and an awful lot of anguish for me to try to evaluate. And people say, well, don't you believe God is or is not? Or what? I don't know. I'm not that smart. But I also can tell you I'm not smart enough to evaluate it, even if I thought he is doing something.
Right. For those of us that have been entrenched in Christianity and in the concept that God is responding to our every thought and every deed and every action and every concept that we embrace, this is a very hard thing. We say it so easily now, Michael, having been down this road for, you know, well over a decade, probably closer to two decades. We say it almost flippantly that we have no problem not evaluating God's performance in our lives. But so many people, everything that happens, they immediately associate what God is or is not doing in their life based on the response that they're seeing.
Yes.
And what we're saying, folks, is that God is not involved in rewarding you or punishing you in any way, shape, or form. period. Whether you believe in complete and utter freedom, like Michael does, for it was for freedom that Christ set us free, or in predestination or sovereignty, the way I believe, it doesn't make a difference. Both bring you to the same end, that God has performed whatever righteous act he's going to have done based on the cross, and whether God is intimately involved in your situation or not, it's not based, Michael, on what we do or don't do, or what we think or what we don't think, or where we go or where we don't go.
Yeah, the reward system was done away with 2,000 years ago, and that was reward for sin or reward for righteousness. Jesus is our reward, and I don't need any further reward other than that. And to live this life in that mindset for me has been freedom from a mental institution, to be quite honest with you. Literal freedom from a mental institution. You know, a lot of people sit in church and hear those things and, you know, say, sarah, sarah, they let them come and go. But I tell you, those of us who truly listen, you're on your way to the mental institution. And
unless.
Excuse me?
I said unless.
Yeah, unless that you, number one, first off, if you just simply do not take it to heart, but unless, and those are the people that we're finding, it's those people who have taken it truly to heart, who seem to be those who brilliantly understand the gospel. It's easy for them because they weren't half-hearted about God in the first place. The gospel of Jesus Christ does not attract half-hearted people.
Right.
Who are just on a religious trip. The gospel that I've been preaching all of these years now and sharing and teaching in any way that I can, it reaches those who have sought with the most sincerity of heart of all the people that I could possibly think of. The nominal church pew sitter, it doesn't mean a whole lot to them. But to those who have taken, I don't care who, if they've taken Catholic doctrine totally to heart, if they've taken Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, any of them that have taken their doctrines, or Nazarene, who've totally taken it to heart, the gospel is tailor-made for you. Now, the gospel has affected everyone, but not everyone is going to see the need for it in their life, even though everybody does need it. But those who are most impacted by the gospel are those who have sought most desperately to understand the relationship with God.
I was flying up from Tampa yesterday to northern Wisconsin, and sitting in front of me was a woman from England who was at the meeting that we mentioned last week in Lakeland. She had flown in from England to go to this meeting in Florida that the healing and the powerful manifestations of God was being preached, and still is being preached tonight as we speak. And she was in front of me, so I really didn't have a chance to talk to her much, but I felt so bad for her, because here was a woman who had obviously spent a significant amount of money coming around halfway around the world, Michael, to see the manifestation of God, and she did not need to come that far. All she needed to do was to have read the prophets and the Psalms and the law and to realize that it had been fulfilled in Christ. She could have received it in England, like many of our listeners who are listening in the United Kingdom right now have received
absolutely.
It. And
pastors and ministers and people are writing books now from that area of the world from a short visit that I made there. Many years ago now.
Well, we encourage those folks. We'll give you titles if you call us. Or if you write us. But we're up against the clock, Michael. Another hour of the Gospel Revolution webcast has gone by, and it goes by too quickly.
Always when you're having fun.
But imagine, folks, that in November we will have 5 unhindered days to be with each other. And as we said earlier, we want to really encourage you to go to the website and to make your reservations with the Marriott in Houston Just go to gospelrevolution.com. All the information is on the website, and just follow the instructions, and you'll be in count. We really need you to step up right now and to let your presence be known for the convention in Houston in November. And we've got about 30-plus rooms left in our initial commitment to Marriott, and we're counting on you. So go to gospelrevolution.com. On there is all the information about the convention in Houston in November. Also, all the latest teachings and CDs from Michael, as well as information about the webcast and about how to invite Mike to your area, and also to keep up your monthly giving at gospelrevolution.com. That will do it for us tonight. This is a short trip for me, Mike. Usually I'm in northern Wisconsin for at least a couple of weeks, but a quick turnaround this time. So, Lord willing, if the creek don't rise, I'll be back in the Tampa studios next week.
Yes, we look forward to your return.
And you're not going anywhere. But we want to thank everybody for listening tonight and for emailing us, and also Sean O'Halloran, our engineer and producer, Kristen Shira, our studio audience. And until next time, this is Glenn Klein Online saying, Shalom, everybody!